So glad you've tuned to At Issue this afternoon. I'm Ben Marins. Our second hour, we talk about oil and gas, the relationship between the two, and understanding just what's going on with the supply and demand in this country and in the world. By the way, how much did you pay for gas the last time you put some in your tank? Climbing up there, it's almost $3 a gallon. And the price of oil is over $80, over $82. What's going on? What drives it? And how does it affect how we drive? Antonia Juhas joins us to talk about the oil industry, the gas industry, and how the consumer fits in. She directs the Chevron Project at Global Exchange. She's also the author of The Tyranny of Oil, the World's Most Powerful Industry, What We Must Do to Stop It. It recently came out in paperback. She joins us by phone, so can you, at 800-486-8655. Post a thought about the subject at Facebook, at Issue with Ben Marins, or email a note, talk@WPR.org. Antonia, welcome back to At Issue.
Well, thanks so much for having me. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. How are you?
I'm doing great. Thank you.
And if you're out and about trying to put gas in your tank, your wallet's a little lighter these days. And a month ago when I talked about the price of oil with someone, it was about $6 a barrel less. So at least we're seeing gas and oil price-wise together. Sometimes we don't, but usually it's because oil is going down, gas doesn't seem to drop. It goes up together quite frequently. Maybe we should start with why that is.
Yeah, that's a pretty consistent trend. It's called rockets and feathers. Basically, the price of gasoline rockets up with the price of oil and then slowly feathers back down, even if the price of oil drops down quickly. And that has everything to do, very simply, with consolidation in the oil and gasoline industry. Basically, we have vertically integrated markets where the same company explores for the oil, produces the oil, transports it, refines it, and sells it, and they're able to control the linkage between price in a way that works well for them, which is that even if the price of oil has gone down, they can take their time choosing to align the price of gasoline with the reduction in the price of oil.
We hear a lot about the price of a barrel when the newscast ends, or if gas is going up, we'll hear about that, or if it's dropping some, we may hear about that. What really drives this a lot is how much oil is refined into gasoline. We don't hear much about that, except about this time of year, two things happen, especially in the Midwest. We hear about refineries needing to be closed to be for some sort of maintenance work, and we also switch over into summer gas in the Midwest because of air pollution issues. Mm-hmm. And what's changed, and we don't hear much about, is how many refineries are there to do the work.
Well, you know, it's been a really ruckus 2 years in the world of gasoline and oil. And if we were having this conversation a year ago, it would be very different. And if we were having it a year before that, it would be very different. Essentially, we've had two dramatically important changes. The first was the extreme lack of regulation in futures markets that led to the incredible run-up in the price of oil, up to $150 a barrel 2 years ago. Then the financial collapse, which had everything to do with the run-up in the price of oil.
You say the collapse on Wall Street was tied into this?
Yeah, if we look at basically the last time the price of oil, the only other time in history adjusted for inflation that oil went above $100 a barrel was in 1981. And what immediately followed was a global recession. The reason why is that our global economy is hardwired to the price of oil. When the price of oil rises, countries have to pay more for oil, their pocketbooks contract, they buy less of other products, which means that countries that sell other products and depend on them, like wheat or coffee, are selling less products, and then they have less money on that end. And the whole economy goes into free fall, which happened in 1981. Same thing happened the beginning of 2008. The price of oil went above $100 a barrel for only the second time in history. And as a result, we had a financial collapse. Now, add on to the $100 a barrel oil the same forces that drove the price up in 2008, which was deregulation in futures markets for in mortgage markets, in the banking sector, oil futures. That deregulation is what drove crazy prices all across the market and eventually led to collapses across the market. And the price of oil was one of the driving factors for making the collapse as severe as it was. And the collapse in the price of oil, the movement of energy traders out of oil for a time, the financial recession, which led to a severe reduction in demand for oil products, particularly gasoline, then led to a collapse in the entire industry in terms of the profits that the oil industry had available, in terms of the sales of its products. And what we're seeing right now domestically is that there has been a real slump in demand for gasoline. At the same time, there's a oversupply. Last year, domestically, we produced more oil than we've produced in decades. Companies expanded their refining capacity because they thought the ride was going to keep going up. The ride has not. It's collapsed. The demand has collapsed, and we've got an oversupply of oil, an oversupply of gasoline. And from the perspective of the oil companies, prices that are way too low, prices that they can't sustain.
So, wait a minute. You've got demand down, supply up, a gallon of gas not below $2 a gallon, but almost at $3 a gallon, and a barrel of oil not going down to $50 or $40 a barrel, but over $80 again. How is that explained? It seems to go against all the economic principles that are basic.
Yes, sorry, hard to get this nice and simple because all the economic principles are spinning on their heads. One of the things that's happened domestically, just to talk in the, we'll talk about immediate issues to make it maybe easier to understand. What refiners have done, and these are all the same companies, remember. So when I talk about a refiner, let's use one company. Let's use Chevron as the example. Chevron is the oil producer. It's also the oil refiner. It's also the gasoline seller. What Chevron has done, as have all the other companies, is reduced the amount of oil significantly that they refine into gasoline to try and deal with this, from their perspective, an overcapacity. So they're refining only about 80% as much as they were, say, a year ago. And they're trying to, as quickly as they can, reduce the available supply of gasoline. They're trying to do that to get the price of gas back up, and it's anticipated that that's going to happen, that gasoline will get back up to $3 a barrel or more fairly soon.
So $3 a gallon?
A gallon, excuse me.
And that we're seeing right now, is that ahead of the curve of the refining production drop?
That's them starting to get, from their perspective, basically, they've cut significantly the amount that they're refining right now. They had an overcapacity, so they're still trying to get rid of the capacity, and they're doing that by significantly reducing how much they refine.
Now, is this just good business practice, that if you want to be profitable, you obviously don't want to have too much product on the market, and when you see that that's what's going on, you bring it back? Or is there some other condition here we should be discussing in terms of what they should be producing and at what price?
Well, you know, there's a lot of different factors we want to take into account. So one is the potential, which is not a good market practice, which is collusion. You know, there's only a handful of refiners. There's even fewer refineries now because we've already seen, because of the reduction in demand over the last year, five U.S. refineries have closed. The big players are starting to sell off their refineries. So Chevron just announced 2 weeks ago that it's selling its refinery in Wales. It might reduce its refining capacity in Hawaii. It's firing 2,000 employees in its downstream refining and selling of gasoline sector. It's also selling off a number of its company-owned gasoline stations. you know, these are big changes, and these are changes happening across the industry. But to get back to your question, if the few companies that are left that control the remaining 120 refineries, 130 refineries in the United States, depending on where things end up when they start selling them off, if they're all doing the same thing, if they're all reducing in the same amount, if they're getting priced to the same place, if they're doing it in collusion with one another, then that's against our antitrust laws, and that's against the law. Certainly, they've all lost a lot of money selling gasoline. And the reason for that is the economy, but it's also, you know, a fundamental shift in the United States away from gasoline towards more fuel-efficient cars, towards hybrids, towards public transportation, people flying less. And that is, it's expected that basically the United States hit its capacity of demand for the whole slate of gasoline products, whether it's diesel or what's used in our cars, that the high point of demand is going to be 2007, and it's never going to reach that point again. And they're all losing money. And so for good business practices, yes, they're going to tighten their belts, and they're going to try and get more out of gasoline if they can. Then there is the side that is what's good for consumers, and should we be putting in place subsidies or tax breaks that help subsidize a lower price of gasoline? And then there's the environment. Overall, this is a good trend away from gasoline that we actually want to see our society move into, and that maybe as long as we've got a government, which we do with the Obama administration, that's actually putting in an investment, although it could be a lot more, into alternative fuels and alternative modes of transportation, that maybe it's okay that the price of gasoline starts to go back up so that we can start making that transition more quickly away from these products.
A quick break and the chance for you to talk to Antonia Yuhas this hour. We're talking about oil and gasoline, their connection, where the refinery issue plays into this, and your comments and questions about whether or not you want to see higher priced oil, lower priced oil, and maybe the fact that you have very little control over it. Antonia Yuhas is author of The Tyranny of Oil, the World's Most Powerful Industry, and What We Must Do to Stop It. She directs the Chevron program at Global Exchange. You can join us at 800-486-8655. I'm Ben Marins, and this is At Issue. Nice to have you tuned to At Issue this afternoon. Oil and gas on our minds, trying to understand the pricing and the business operations and the trends. Tomorrow morning, you can tune in to John Munson in for Joy Cardine. One more day after 8 tomorrow, and it's the Week in Review. You can hear discussion from guests on the left and the right. You can take part and hear about the news stories that shaped our world this week. That show bookended tomorrow at 4 o'clock with your views on the news, where you can call in and tell me what you think the most significant story of the week has been to you and why. Oil on our minds in this hour. And again, Antonia, I appreciate your time. Thank you for being here.
You bet. Thanks for having me.
We spoke, I think it was about 2 years ago, at the Alternative Energy Conference, and we talked about the higher price of oil leading to higher gas, taking us away from the car that we know in terms of the gas run engine with the oil based product. And we started to see some of that. We talked about, well, how much money does it take for a barrel of oil or a gallon of gas to get so we'll run away from those cars? We're seeing a slow movement, but there's still a lot of vehicles out there that are going to be putting in oil based gas and not hybrid or battery operated car or anything else for that matter. How do you see the pricing of this affecting the consumer in terms of how we'll act and behave?
Well, I think we've seen a trend that is very likely to be locked in unless something really changes in the way our policy moves. So in terms of policies, we've seen we're going to have an increased fuel efficiency standard applied to all cars. We have increased requirements on components of ethanol and the use of ethanol. We have, if Obama's budget goes through, $36 billion plus in tax breaks and subsidies that are going to be eliminated for the oil industry, making its its operations have to essentially compete more on par with other types of fuels. And on the other end, we're seeing tax incentives and subsidies being applied to alternative fuels and investments in alternative energy. And policy is shifting away from subsidizing oil and gas and in favor of alternatives. We haven't seen, I think, what is necessary for investments in public transportation, which I think are far more important at the end of the day. But I think we're pushing that direction. And we're also seeing changes in basic consumer practices. People are shifting away from driving. They are shifting towards public transportation. A lot of that has been forced into play because of the recession. But when you look at polls longer-term views taken in polls of people about driving, about the use of public transportation, about their desire and demand for hybrids, for electric vehicles, the direction the United States is going is now following Europe. We're behind in lots of other places, lots of other countries, in really shifting away from the overall use of petroleum-based products. And I think the clearest sign that the oil industry sees that happening in the United States is, as I was saying, closing refineries, closing gas stations, or at least shifting gas stations from being company-owned, really for the oil industry seeing that its future is tied less to gasoline in the United States and, unfortunately, more tied towards oil itself as a resource. So we're seeing, for example, Exxon, Chevron, BP really aggressively moving their investments this year into far more expensive and difficult and environmentally destructive modes of oil production to get their hands on every last drop they can, moving more aggressively in the tar sands of Canada, deep offshore in our oceans, trying to get access to California's offshore fields, to Florida's offshore fields, really tricky operations for both oil and natural gas in the Midwestern United States, Exxon moving into Iraq, the first U.S. oil company to produce oil in Iraq in 30 years. You know, the trend is to get more aggressive on oil, where the money is definitely going to stay, and to shift away from gasoline, at least in the United States. Asia and India are different markets.
I want to ask you some more questions about the supply and demand cost of oil, because the oil has to be pretty high to get into the tar sands profitably, but I want to get some calls for you before the break.
Yeah.
Rain in Sheboygan next. Hi.
Hi. My question, I guess what I wanted to know, is there any correlation between the price of gasoline and the political affiliation of the president in office? And I guess that's pointed, I guess, directly at the Bush administration specifically and the war in Iraq. You know, if that spike that you had referred to previously had anything to do with the Bush administration specifically.
It certainly did in terms of the policies. So you saw the Bush administration working very aggressively to open up new areas of access for oil companies domestically and internationally. I've written extensively on the role of oil in the war in Iraq, and, you know, the sort of easiest sentence to wrap your head around is, if Iraq grew bananas instead of oil, would we have ever, you know, decided to go in? And would ExxonMobil be walking away with the first major contract for oil production in 30 years in that country? Subsidies to the industry, tax breaks to the industry, reduction in environmental controls. The Obama administration has definitely not only outright trying to reduce taxes and subsidies to the industry, but also regulating greenhouse gas emissions, putting new costly regulations onto the industry. all of that translates in the end of the day into the profitability of the industry and the amount of control that the industry is able to exert, I think, over price, because that also gets to, do you have a federal government that is interested in looking more closely at issues like collusion and price fixing? And so I think very, very clearly you see policy differences translate into profit and price.
Although under the Obama administration, we're seeing the refineries close here. We're seeing the price of oil going back up. Gas is going back up. Is that something that you put at the feet of the Obama administration, or just happens to coincide with the fact that he's in office?
I think I put the price of oil going back up as definitely at the foot of the Obama administration in a failure, and that it has not acted in any way to regulate the futures market, which is the reason why the price is going back up more than any other reason. And actually what you have, very interestingly, is the person who Obama put in to sit at the head of the Commodity Futures Trading Commission, the CFTC, which has the regulatory authority to rein in futures trading, has been trying to do that. And he's been trying to do it out of character. He really had a come-to-Jesus moment when he took office. And he had actually been someone who in previous administrations had been part of the deregulation, who is now trying very hard to put in place regulation, going head-to-head against Obama's Treasury Secretary, against Laura Summers, against the rest of the members of the administration. So this is a place where, overall, the Obama administration is following the practices of the Bush administration to the detriment of, you know, to the vagaries of pushing the price of oil up instead of having it being pushed up for policy reasons, which we might want to try and curtail the use of this fossil fuel, being pushed up for trading reasons.
We take a break for news. We come back. More calls for you, Antonia Juhas, and your opportunity to call her, 800-486-8655. Antonia Juhas, an oil industry watchdog, director of the Chevron program at Global Exchange. 800-486-8655. News is next. You're listening to Ad Issue, and I am so glad that you are. I'm Ben Marins. In this hour, we talk about the price of oil and gasoline, the relationship between the two, and try to understand some of the politics involved as well. Antonia Juhas watches the oil industry. She writes about it, speaks about it quite frequently. Our guest this hour, more about her, by the way, and her book, Tyranny of Oil, online. If you go to WPR.org, we've got links to both. You can join the conversation, by the way, at 800-486-8655. Posting your thoughts on Facebook for us are welcome, too. That's At Issue with Ben Marins. And emailing at talk@WPR.org. Antonia, as we were going to break talking about the movement into oil for products other than gasoline, when we spoke 2 years ago here in Wisconsin at the Alternative Energy Conference, there was a thought that oil is going to have to be at $150 or $200 a barrel to make the tar sands investigation and removing the oil from the tar sands profitable. Has technology changed? It doesn't have to be that high, or is that still the price point?
It's more that there just is less accessible oil, and the oil industry successfully got the United States Security and Exchange Commission to allow them to start booking reserves from the tar sands, and what that means is counting the reserves that they hold in the tar sands as oil reserves that the companies hold as their own. The higher their oil reserves, really the higher their stock price goes. And that's another element that makes it more attractive to move into the tar sands. The other is simply that there is less accessible oil left in the world, and the price of oil, even though it had its insane run up and run down, it's recovered quite swiftly, and it's certainly anticipated that the price is going to continue to go up, and that means you want to get your hands on what oil is left out there. And the tar sand oil, while expensive, is one of the last big pools. It's similar in a different way to the risk of, for security reasons, of going into Iraq and having a a 100,000 U.S. troop occupation be the means to allow you access to a country's oil. Producing oil in Iraq is very inexpensive just in terms of getting it out of the ground. It's about $1.50 a barrel to get it out of the ground, or even $1 a barrel to get it out of the ground. There's obviously a lot of other circumstances, and ExxonMobil is a big U.S. company willing to take that gamble.
We move to the phones again. Dan and Racine next. Hi, Dan.
Hi. My question is, why isn't there more promotion of companies like Tesla, and why aren't there companies such as Energizer that are given tax incentives to work with companies like Tesla?
I'm not sure that I agree that there hasn't been that much promotion of Tesla. I think, particularly under the Obama administration, I think we're really seeing a movement towards trying to support and subsidize venture capitalism and government subsidies for hybrids, electric cars, so they're all the biofuels, and I actually think the administration is doing quite well there, and I think that we're starting to see a real push for both demand and production of these cars. Tesla in particular has tended to have a very, very high-end model, I think, which is one of the reasons why it's so expensive still. But I think we're seeing across the board with other companies and other producers a much broader investment in and production of electric cars and hybrid cars. So I actually think that trend is moving in the right direction. The piece that I actually think is missing most significantly, as I said before, is the investments in public transportation, modes of transportation that get us away from the passenger vehicle, single passenger vehicle.
Dan, I appreciate the call and the question. Lauren in Delavan next. Hi, Lauren.
Hi, thank you very much, Ben, for taking my call. And again, the best show on the radio.
Thank you.
All right. First question I have is, I've been hearing your guests say a lot how hybrid cars are going to help, but I hope she understands that hybrid cars are not electric cars. Is that true? Or do you do realize that, right?
Yes, I do realize that. Thank you.
Right. Okay. And number two, the question of the manipulation of a futures market is to somehow help people. Every time markets have ever been manipulated or regulated the way you're suggesting, have resulted in shortages, which are really going to help the poorest people in this country who are already having a terrible time trying just to find a job and get around. And now, you know, what you're suggesting is going to hurt them even more. Are you taking that into account?
A little bit of a hard time following your question, but let me...
Let me make it clear. If you're going to regulate the futures market so that I cannot have a wild swing of prices, mm-hmm. what you're going to do is you're going to create shortages. That happens economically every time. So if you create shortages, that means the price of oil is going to go skyrocketing. If it skyrockets, that means the price of gasoline is going to go up, and the people who can least afford this big impact are going to be the ones who are going to have to pay for it.
Yeah, I would disagree with the premise that regulating the futures market would lead to a rise in the price, given that it was deregulation that allowed us to get to basically the two times that we've seen the most dramatic increase in the price of oil. One was straight on intentional manipulation of price, which happened in the late 1970s and early 1980s, which was a political intentional move to increase the price of oil by oil producing countries. The second was in 2008, which was when, as a result of deregulation in the futures market, we saw energy traders moving aggressively into oil and pushing, creating a false demand and what most analysts believe probably doubling the price of oil from what it would have been had there not been the free-for-all. The other side of the free-for-all was as soon as the market became unstable and traders needed to protect their interests, they quickly left that sector and the price collapsed. What regulation would give us would be stability. Now, I'm not sure. I mean, I think that the price of oil should be high. I think it should be high because I think we need to move away from the products, and I think it should be high because if you take into account the human rights, the environmental, the social costs of this product, it should be much higher even than it is. But I think we should be doing it in a controlled manner where the price is being captured not by Exxon or BP or Chevron, but captured by our governments so that we can take that money and invest it into alternatives. So just as you say, consumers who can't afford the price of gasoline going up actually have real alternatives to turn to. And I would certainly reiterate your point that a hybrid isn't an electric car, that a hybrid still uses gasoline. And to reiterate my point, which is that what I actually think the solution is mass transit, not finding more ways to move fewer people around in smaller entities, whether they're being moved by electricity or hybrids or gasoline.
Lauren, I appreciate the call and the kind words about the program. You know, I've talked to economists across this country, a lot of whom maintain that the problem with mass transit development is the costs are so great, the recoup that you're talking about in theory doesn't happen in reality. It's just never going to be as cheap to put that mass transit as far as we need it to be, as comprehensive to move people, as it is to have fuel-efficient cars or electric cars or hybrids.
Well, it's where you're measuring the word cheap, but who the cost is borne by and who receives the profit. So we have social goods, and a social good that is more intangible in terms of return on an investment is a reduction in greenhouse gas emissions, is a reduction in toxins and other pollutants. You know, cars aren't just about, don't just create pollution through their exhaust pipe. They create pollution in their production. They create pollution in their disposal. They create pollution when they're standing still, because there tends to be a tremendous amount of loss of fuel even from a standing car. And we have a social good, which is moving people in larger numbers using it less fossil fuels.
Antonia Juhas, our guest, 800-486-8655. If you want to join us, lines open for you. In Mequon, Tom next. Hi, Tom.
Hi. Interesting show. A nice guest, but I have to disagree. I think that oil price should be low as possible, and I think that the government should actually get involved in making gasoline and open up clean refining plants. and I think if it doesn't, that you're not going to see the economy get better, and I'm tired of hearing this country compared to Europe, you know, and their buses and trains and stuff like that. This is a big country; it's very spread out. We need personal transportation, and gasoline is the cheapest way to do it, and really the best way. The hybrids—they've got these batteries with these expensive metals in them that, when the batteries are done, who knows what they're going to do with them? Are they going to bury them or just what? And to get the nickel out of the ground for the batteries is one of the worst processes for the earth, meaning that it's hard on the earth. The windmills, this state, people don't want them. They're fighting any new ones. And plus, it's, you know, windmills are a loser.
Tom, do me a favor. Hold on. I don't want you to go away, but you've said plenty. I want response to before you get a follow-up if you want it. Antonia?
You know, I definitely hear your point on that there are environmental costs associated with electric cars, which are certainly not given nearly as much attention as they should. The production of the batteries is also very harmful for the workers involved. There's almost no way to protect workers from the production of all, particularly in lithium batteries. Disposal is difficult. Production is difficult, which is, again, for me, the point why we want to reduce each of these modes of transport as much as we can. And I will share your point. It's as much as we can. We are a big country, and people still need to get around. The overall issue is basically, I would say, reduction of consumption. So wind isn't perfect. Solar isn't perfect. What we have to try and do is reduce our use of energy and reduce our use of the most harmful components. So I also disagree that there's such a thing as a clean refinery. There just isn't. We have yet to come up with any way of making the process of refining oil into gasoline in any way resembling a clean process. It's very dangerous to the people who work in the refineries. It's very dangerous to the people who live by them. And unfortunately, the type of oil the world is moving into, which we've just crossed to the point where more than 50% of the world's oil is now what's called heavy oil. That's more sulfur, dirtier oil, basically. That's what's left. There's no way to refine dirtier oil into gasoline without creating more pollution, more toxic pollution, and more greenhouse gases. So I think the bottom line is that we have to try and use less and use the cleanest products we can, knowing that there's no such thing as the clean or perfect product.
Tom?
Okay, but again, gasoline is by far the most inexpensive, and the working people in this country, that's the only thing we can afford. Everything else is a loser, and it's going to keep pushing us down and maybe, you know, a lot farther down.
Tom, I appreciate the call. The follow-up, Antonio, the idea that, you know, economically, those of us who don't have lots of money are going to need a gasoline-run car?
Yeah, and I disagree. Person per person, it's much less expensive, again, to move people in public transportation, and is significantly less expensive for someone to take, when it's available, to take public transportation than to own or operate your own car. But also,
he made the point that our country is designed in such a way that most people live in areas that can't do that.
Yeah, which means we have to move ourselves in the direction as much as we can of limiting the distances that we travel for work and consumption of products and creating better mass transit. But also just to say, again, on this issue of cheap, there are many costs associated and subsidies associated with the production of oil, the transport, the refining, the selling of gasoline, steep, steep costs borne in the environment, in human rights, in our climate. These are important to everybody across the board. And when we look at the word expense, we have to include all of those costs into the expense. And those costs have gotten us to a place where, our climate can no longer bear the choices that we're making. And the costs are getting to be, monumental. And we have to start rethinking the way we move ourselves around.
Tom, again, appreciate the call. A quick break. More calls for Antonia Juhas. We talk about oil and gas and the impact they have on our economy and our society, what the future holds. What are your questions about all this? We have some time for you. 800-486-8655. Toll free. We'll take your call. You can email us at talk@WPR.org. Antonia Juhas directs the Chevron program at Global Exchange, author of the book, The Tyranny of Oil. Email links if you go to WPR.org to both sites for her book and her work site. Nice to have you listening to At Issue, and I hope you'll be back tomorrow afternoon, our 4 o'clock hour, as it always is on Fridays. Your views on the news, where you can call in and talk about the news story of the week that had the most significance for you. Our 5 o'clock hour, well, it's a bit personal for me this week. We'll talk about the lessons we learn from the dogs we've had and loved. I had to put an old friend down this week, and I miss him greatly. We'll talk a little bit about him and a lot about the dogs that you've learned your lessons from. What are some of the basic lessons we've learned? Our guest has written a book about that. We'll talk to John Schmidt tomorrow, and you can too. Antonia Juhas, our guest in this hour. And Antonia, back to the phones. John in Oak Creek is next. Hi, John.
Hi, how are you?
I'm fine. How are you?
Great. I just had a question related to fuel cells. For a while, it seems like we heard so much about fuel cells. I certainly believe that with a electric motor powering a vehicle, you know, things are a lot better, a lot less complex, a lot cheaper. But I understand there's a problem with batteries. I was just wondering if you guys could share anything about the status of fuel cells and how they fit into this equation.
Appreciate the call, John. Thanks very much. Antonia?
I'm sorry, I can't. Maybe another caller can. I know a lot more about oil than I know about any other product.
Well, another day, maybe a whole other hour, John, and I appreciate the call.
Yes.
And as we look into alternative uses for transportation, assuming that mass transit isn't the answer, is there a technology that you're following or a path that you hope we'll take versus where we're at today?
I think the most hopeful paths are really the production of alternative fuels, alternative resources that are localized. So as much as possible, you grow the alternative fuel near your community. You transform it into a usable fuel in your community. You create the pumps to put it into your vehicle in your community, and then you drive within your community. It's basically getting as localized as we can and then using to generate the energy for production, the cleanest modes of energy that we can. And that also gets at some of the problems around solar and wind that are, you know, mass solar fields, mass wind fields, or, for example, for agriculture crops, the shifting on a mass scale of biofuel crops from food into biofuels. And fortunately, we've moved into investments in what are called second-generation biofuels, which are not based on agricultural crops. The next stage to get to is localization of production. So we're not creating mass modes of production in the alternative sphere, just as we have done in the fossil fuel sphere, which, you know, as an earlier caller had suggested, leads to its own has its own subsequent problems. So again, it's reducing consumption and localizing production.
Aaron in Elkhorn next for Antonio Yuhas. Hi, Aaron.
Hi. The biggest change that we have to make is getting past zoning restrictions. Everything that we every time a new subdivision comes up, it's going to be farther away. We don't. Nobody works near where they live, or shop where they live. Everything's so far flung away. Even if you live in a major metropolitan area, if you can't just walk down to the shopping center or something, work is always going to be farther away than where we are.
Aaron, I hear what you're saying. Sort of local zoning and planning, I know it's not exactly your expertise, but is something that you've got something to say about?
Absolutely. I think, and part of that is issues around, we've passed many regulations in California and various locations against, for example, big box stores. One of the problems with big box stores is they are so large, they have to be built farther away and outside of communities, so people have to drive from big box to big box to big box, whereas you used to, you know, go into your downtown and go to all of your stores and keep your mode of getting your resources walking and keeping the benefits of those resources localized as well. And I think it's a zoning issue. I think it's also, again, this issue of localization, getting the sources that we get all of our products from that your caller is bringing up, into one centralized area in smaller modes of access. And I think that has to do with zoning. It has to do with local production, local selling, local stores, and the size of the stores as well.
Aaron, I appreciate the call. Thanks very much. Those of you on hold, another day. Antonia will come back. We'll gladly get to you and your calls. As we wrap up here, Antonia, you see that the individual who wants to make a difference and do something has a role to play that's clear, or is it kind of fuzzy what we can do as just one or two people?
Not at all. I mean, this is all about the moves of local people, of individual people, but acting as groups. So it's been the movement of individuals moving away from our cars that has really been transforming the industry and making the transformations we've seen. And it's the demand of individuals as a group for policy changes at the local level, the state level, national and international, demands for climate legislation internationally and nationally that is really fundamentally shifting the future of both this industry and the way that we get energy. So this is we are absolutely at a critical moment for the climate, for wars, for our economy, for individuals to make very clear and very decisive demands of our policymakers, but also changes in your individual actions around the way we use energy and the way we think about our government in relation to the energy industries.
Antonia, I appreciate the time.
Thank you so much for having me, and thanks to the callers.
You're welcome. Antonia Yuhas is the author of The Tyranny of Oil, the World's Most Powerful Industry and What We Must Do to Stop It. She directs the Chevron program at Global Exchange. The email addresses to follow her are at WPR.org, and you can link to her there. Had production support from Katie Madsen this afternoon on this hour. Mimi Notstein, our on-air producer and director, and we thank her for that. We thank all of you who tuned in and called in. You can join us tomorrow. Your views on the news. And if you want to post a thought about the news story that affected you most, go to our Facebook site at Issue with Ben Merens. We also tomorrow will talk about the lessons we've learned from our dogs. And you can post thoughts about that at Facebook, too. In the meantime, have a great evening and be well. I look forward to wrapping up our talk week with you right here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Ben Merens, and this program is All at Issue.